Sunstone presents Pseudo-Polyandry, explaining Mormons' polygyny's paradoxical companion, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
Richard Van Wagner has prepared independent remarks. Andrew E. Hatt is a Ph.D. candidate at the University of Southern Illinois. Richard Van Wagner is an audiologist and author of Mormon Polygamy, A History. Let me turn the time to these speakers.
At the inaugural Sunstone Theological Symposium held in Washington, D.C., I presented a paper having the same title as today's presentation. This presentation is an abbreviated version of that paper. The details, however, are the same. In that paper, I reviewed the historical literature of Mormon polyandry up to, but not including, the researches of Richard Van Wagner, my distinguished commentator. Because I wrote that paper without knowledge of Mr. Van Wagner's research, I naturally made no reference to his analysis of the subject. In the year and a half since delivering that paper, Mr. Van Wagner has published three pieces interpreting Nauvoo polyandry. A short piece appeared recently in an issue of Sunstone, based both on the untitled chapter 4 of his book, Mormon Polygamy, A History, as well as on his article published in Dialogue entitled Mormon Polyandry and Nauvoo. By the way, let me just say, for the benefit of those that don't understand the distinction between the general terms polyandry and polygyny, polyandry is that practice in which marriage exists between a multiple of men with one woman, and polygyny refers to the marriage form of a man having more than one wife. The purpose of this paper is to present my definition of the type of polyandry which existed in the formative stages of Mormon polygyny. I will begin by presenting a general review of the Mormon polyandry literature. I will then explain why I feel it has been historically inaccurate to leave unqualified and undefined in that literature the term polyandry. I intend to focus on this subject both from more macroscopic as well as microscopic points of view than have previously been attempted. From the macroscopic viewpoint, I will suggest some etymological and anthropological reasons for why we should be far more precise in using the term polyandry. Then, in combination with this perspective, I will incorporate my more microscopic analysis, which I feel yields a new framework for understanding the previously unscrambled clues, which to me explain the real Mormon polyandry, what I have come to term pseudo-polyandry. If polygyny is the most controversial story in the history of Mormonism, polyandry must surely be its darkest, least understood, and most troubling chapter. For while the late Fawn M. Brody's theoretical framework for polyandry in Nauvoo has only been modified and further refined by more careful historical successors, nevertheless, her basic analysis of the data regarding the sexual activity of those engaged in polyandry remains basically unchallenged. In fact, except for one case, no matter how brilliant the theoretical hand-waving, the bottom-line assertion of Brody still is uncontradicted, that the women who chose to enter the quagmire of polyandry often continued sexual relations with their former husbands, while at the same time they commenced them with another man to whom they had been sealed. This is the reason why the student of early Mormon polygyny faces no more perplexing problem than explaining the paradoxical role polyandry played in the formative stages of LDS history. In the wake of Fawn Brody's biography of Joseph Smith, no one has, in my opinion, counterproposed a model of Nauvoo polyandry which harmonizes all of the available data. The other scholars may not have phrased it this way, but the essence of Brody's answer to the question everyone has is still the same. Of the prophet, she said, Joseph could, with a certain honesty, inveigh against adultery in the same week that he slept with another man's wife, or indeed several men's wives, because he had interposed a very special ceremony, and who was to say him nay, since the Gentile world, by the simple pronouncement of a few time-worn phrases, by any justice of the peace, was all that was necessary to transform fornication into blessed matrimony. The spoken word, she concluded, stood between him and his own guilt, and with Joseph, the word was God. Joseph, according to Brody, had cleverly decided that he would satisfy his urging for liaisons by limiting the field only to married women, thus minimizing the risk of paternity detection. Similarly, for the women, Brody says, But the true measure of the magnetism of plural marriage can be best seen in the attitude of the Mormon women. They required very little more persuasion than the men, though the reasons are not so obvious. Nauvoo was a severe town, puritanical and acutely self-righteous, but a town full of church widows whose husbands were out proselyting, which created circumstances that made many women find polyandry to their liking. Yes, what of these married women who gladly signed themselves and their children over to the prophet's keeping and glory for eternity, leaving their unwitting husbands to be wifeless and childless in the celestial kingdom? Was this a melancholy commentary on their own marriage state, or a tribute to Joseph's charm? Or was it perhaps a smothered yearning for new experiences released now by opportunity masquerading as religious duty? Well, the best scholars who have written since Brodie's analysis have been a bit more cautious. But as I say, the fundamental question regarding sexual activity after alleged polyandry remains unclear and unresolved. John A. Widtsoe, obliquely responding to Brodie's sweeping generalizations, argued that all marriages of the sort were for eternity only. Unaware, however, of solid evidence to the contrary, he was incorrect when he suggested that all polyandry-like marriages were only platonic in nature. Because the evidence has been inconclusive on this point, everyone since has, more or less, been ambiguous on this point. Dan L. Bachman concluded that it would be quite speculative to agree with Widtsoe's conclusion that these were wholly celestial or spiritual arrangements. In fact, Bachman's study was the first in which solid evidence was presented, which not only showed that Joseph Smith had sexual relations with a woman who was already legally married to another, but he did so by also showing that Joseph Smith had fathered a child as a result of this relationship. Where's the ambiguity, you might say? The ambiguity is not in the evidence that it happened. His path-breaking analysis simply is not complete enough to explain fully how the parties concerned justified such relationships. Donna Hill was fairly superficial in her analysis. There is evidence that some undeclared polyandry existed in the early stages of Mormon plural marriage, she says. But the next three paragraphs of her study only provide headlines. Unlike Brodie, she refuses to speculate on the nature of Joseph Smith's possible intimacy with these women. Lawrence Foster, author of what must still be considered the best available analysis of early Mormon plural marriage, is the most careful of all the writers who have tackled the subject of polyandry in Nauvoo. Foster improved upon Bachman's theoretical description of the Mormon marriage system. That system rested upon three main premises. One, the concept, which I refer to as priesthood legitimacy. Two, the notion of eternal marriage covenants. And three, the concept that while marriage is generally monogamous in form, polygyny under certain circumstances was condoned. As Foster and Bachman analyzed these concepts, Joseph Smith's idea of priesthood legitimacy gave the prophet authority which not only transcended but superseded civil marriage-making authority. Thus, if Joseph Smith felt that a marriage should be annulled, or if he felt he was authorized to have another wife or another man's wife, he did not necessarily have to appeal to civil authority to do what he intended to do. The notion that marriage could last not only for time but also for all eternity buttressed the credibility of these priesthood prerogatives of the prophet. No one else in the world had the authority to marry for eternity, so his power ultimately was the only legitimate one. Foster, as Bachman had before him, also cited teachings to the effect that if a woman became, quote, alienated in her feelings and affections to her husband, she could, without necessity of divorce, be sealed to another man higher in authority. Foster suggests that it was on the basis of this combination of concepts that Joseph Smith actually asked some men if they were willing to relinquish their wives not only for time, but also for eternity. Foster failed to refer to the cases of women who were members of the church whose husbands were not, whom Joseph Smith also asked to be his eternal wives. Presumably, he would have agreed that such sealings would also have been justified on the same grounds. Now, Foster additionally attempted to explain why Joseph Smith approached wives of his followers who were on the verge of apostasy. He might have justified, Foster says, such an action by the view that since those men had become unworthy and had forfeited their salvation, they had also forfeited their wives. Well, to summarize Foster's position, then, he feels that all previous covenants, suspended concept and the moving up concept cover all documented cases under which Joseph Smith appears to have approached or taken married women as plural wives. Yet, with all this, neither he nor Bachman ever explicitly resolved the issue whether women had sexual relations both with their legal husband and their newly sealed partner. Implicitly, both Foster and Bachman suggest that women did conduct themselves so if they felt there was no other way to conceal from their first husband the relationship begun with the second man. As Foster puts it, given Smith's mindset and concern for authority, it seems inconceivable that he could have done what he apparently did without believing that he had a higher justification for his actions. Richard Van Wagener's analysis of the evidence goes no further in answering this question either. In fact, if I were to summarize the major historical writers on this subject using the dubiously valid political spectrum metaphor as an analogy, I would say that while Foster and Bachman lie midpoint between Brody on the left and Widtsoe on the right, I would have to say that Mr. Van Wagener lies to the left of Foster. How far to the right of Brody he has been unwilling to reveal in his writings. Why I say this is because, unlike Bachman and Foster, who are very clear about their ambiguity on this point, Mr. Wagner only leaves us to infer that what turn these married women's sexual life took after Joseph Smith approached them and succeeded in convincing them to become a plural wife. We have no clue, except perhaps the tone of his presentation, whether he believed intimacy would be conducted with one or two or no husbands. Clearly, the word polyandry has had a myriad of meanings among these scholars, from Brody's unqualified usage to Hill's more restrained reference to undeclared polyandry. Meanings surely have varied. Without question, Foster is the writer who has been the most precise in the use of the term, but was it, for example, just faith-like naivete which led Foster to conclude his analysis of Mormon polyandry by saying that apparent practices of this sort by Joseph Smith have led to erroneous allegations that he sanctioned polyandry? Well, I think not. Obviously, he uses a narrower meaning for the term polyandry than have other writers who have dealt with this issue. While he does not define his usage, it is clear he is relying on an anthropological definition of the term to make the conclusion he does. But even in this case, definition still seems in order, given the fact that he asserts that Joseph Smith did not sanction polyandry, despite his confession that his research could not positively determine whether or not ceilings for eternity were for eternity only. I feel the microscopic portion of my analysis resolves that issue, but first I would like to present the elements of a more macroscopic approach to the polyandry issue. Is there justification for a more precise definition of terms? I feel there are three reasons why greater precision should be employed. First, it is obvious there is good reason, just given the looseness with which students of Mormon history, Mormon plural marriage, have used this term. Additionally, precision in definition is necessary because previous studies of the issue have overlooked crucial data essential to the analysis of this subject. This data I will summarize later. Finally, a redefinition is justified simply because the instances of apparent polyandry in Mormon history are fundamentally different from instances of polyandry among humans in general. It is to this more general area of focus that I would now like to direct your attention. All of the terms polygyny, polyandry, monogamy, and polygamy are derived from Greek words. Polygyny is derived from poly or many, and genia or women. That is, putting the terms together, polygyny is many women. Polyandry is derived from poly, again, meaning many, and andros or men, which when put together gives polyandry as meaning many men. The most popular term, which etymologically and anthropologically speaking is the least accurately used word, is the term polygamy. Poly, many, gamia, marriage. That is, many marriageness. Obviously, monogamy means, as above, single marriageness. Etymology alone, however, is insufficient for our needs here. H.R.H. Prince Peter of Greece and Denmark's A Study of Polyandry is the classic analysis of polyandry among the human species. After discussing a similar etymology, Peter says, "For the purpose of the present thesis, the meaning which I shall attribute to each of these terms is to be as follows. Polygamy, the marriage of more than two persons, one man and one woman in the same union. Polygyny, the marriage of one man to more than one woman. Polyandry, the marriage of one woman to more than one man. Peter went on to explain that he intended to be understood that he was referring to instances of simultaneous and not successive marriages. Anthropologists generally make a distinction between simultaneous and successive types of marriage. For example, simultaneous polygyny is when a man is concurrently married to more than one wife. However, successive polygyny refers to the instance of a man who marries a succession of wives or another wife following the divorce or death of the previous wife. Peter further clarifies his definition of polyandry by precisely defining two additional terms, syscipism and marriage. Having found a wide variety of uses of both of these terms in the previous marriage and family literature, Peter chose to establish his definition as follows. In what concerns polyandry, it can be said that if there is no marriage, a group of men living with one woman, having sexual relations with her, and even procreating children cannot, strictly speaking, be considered polyandrous. For this reason, I shall reserve the term syscipism for an arrangement between the sexes wherein one or more of the male partners is not related to the woman in marriage. But this is higher than just simply a liaison or anything. It's derived from a 17th century Italian term that talked about, that referred to the syscipio, or a gallant, a lover, but was publicly known. Obviously, what distinguishes polyandry from syscipism is marriage. Polyandry consists of shared legal obligations between the partners, while syscipism, though a publicly acknowledged relationship, does not entail similar obligations. Peter's definition of marriage is essential to understanding this point of distinction. Marriage is the union between man and woman in the form recognized by their society, entitling them individually to specific kinship status of husband and wife, jointly to that of spouses with reciprocal rights and obligations, and to the procreation of legitimate children within the union. Obviously, given this definition of marriage, the term polyandry does not apply to the type of relationships which Brody, Bachman, Hill, Foster, and Van Wagner have described as existing in the early history of Mormon polygyny. In fact, strictly speaking, you could say the same about the term polygyny. But how useful is a definition which appears to deny the existence of such a well-documented practice in Mormon history? Well, the definition does not do this at all. Actually, it highlights a point which emerged from my more detailed analysis of the primary sources of Mormon marriage theory and practice. Not too brilliant, but anyway. That Mormon society, when divided into classes according to the distinct levels of understanding which individual Latter-day Saints had regarding the rules and order of marriage, there existed within the Mormon population six concentric circles of knowledge of Mormon marriage theory and practice. Essentially, I derive from, instead of applying Peter's definition as loose enough to say polyandry exists in one society this way and polyandry exists in this society another way, but they are polyandry because they meet the general definition of polyandry. What I'm saying is that within Mormon society, then there were six levels of understanding, and each of these levels were formed separate societies within the group. That's the image I want you to have in mind as I continue to discuss this notion. The first level consisted of those members of the church who had no other understanding than what they understood from their previous cultural experience. The second level came when the convert learned that the church considered the state of marriage a pure and undefiled state before God, that celibacy was not prerequisite to holiness in this life, that marriage as a stage of spiritual maturity should not be contracted with non-Latter-day Saints. Nevertheless, the church would consider such marriage as valid, though members so engaged would be considered weak in faith. Furthermore, those who were at this level understood that marriages pre-existing to membership in the church would be equally valid. Those who reached a third level of understanding, a level of understanding not taught before the Nauvoo period, learned that marriages, if they were to continue into eternity, had to be sealed by the power received by Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery from the angels Elias and Elijah in 1836. The decision would have to be made by both partners of a marriage before they entered the Nauvoo temple and received the endowment and marriage ordinances scheduled to be performed there. A fourth level of understanding came when individuals understood that the church would ratify successive polygyny. That is, Joseph Smith performed eternal marriage ordinances between men and women, after which the woman would stand proxy for the man's previous wife who had died. These persons learned, therefore, that simultaneous polygyny would be a characteristic of some who attained celestial glory. This was the deepest level of doctrinal understanding to which Joseph Smith gave unretracted public exposition. A fifth level of understanding came when individuals learned from Joseph Smith or valid intermediaries that God had commanded him to introduce simultaneous polygyny for several purposes. One, to raise up a righteous seed unto the Lord. Two, to establish on earth marriage covenants which were entered into by men and women before they were born, in the pre-existence, that is. Three, to afford women who might not otherwise marry the opportunity to qualify for exaltation in the celestial kingdom, since one prerequisite for the highest degree of exaltation, which was marriage for eternity. And four, to introduce a means of testing members of the church to see if they qualified for its highest spiritual blessings by demonstrating in this manner their faith that they would do all things God might require them through their prophet. The sixth and deepest level of understanding came when some individuals entered into polyandrous-like relationships in order to fulfill some or all four of the reasons for which simultaneous polygyny was introduced, or the previous level, and that is eternal marriage, the eternal marriage level of three, and the successive polygyny of level four. This level of understanding was always conceived of as only temporary in nature until death, divorce, or resealing permanently altered the polyandrous-like relationship. In effect, these six levels of understanding established within Mormon society, this could be further refined, but that's enough for my purposes today, five coexisting but distinct societies within which Peter's definition of marriage can be applied. Only the sixth level society, those persons engaged in what I will soon define as pseudo-polyandry, were not married, at least in the terms of this life. Each of the five other societies consisted of an internally recognized form of union which entitled the individual so joined the specific kinship status of husband and wife with reciprocal rights and obligations, including the right to procreate legitimate children as a result of the union. The marriage forms associated with the first two levels of Mormon society consisted of well-established civil, common law, or religious public ceremonies which preexisted the establishment of the church. The eternal marriage ceremony associated with the third level society and the successive polygyny marriage ceremony associated with the fourth level society, although unique ordinances of the LDS Church, were nonetheless irreproachable by the law of the land. Only the simultaneous polygynous marriages of fifth level Mormon society could be touched by the laws of the state of Illinois. As I will soon establish, sixth level marriages were not marriages for this life. Thus, other than polygynous marriages, the five other forms were either legal or were extra legal marriages. Joseph Smith never lived to see a sufficient period of peace, so he could, in public sermon, by written revelation, or perhaps by way of treatise, detail his rationale for the complex story of polygyny. Thus, scholars, apologists, and detractors alike have all been left to pick and choose from a very slim amount of available data concerning this controversial topic. Surely the paucity of primary sources regarding early Mormon polygyny in general, and polyandry in particular, should have cautioned all against hasty conclusions. But just as there has been imprecision in the use of the term polyandry, so also has important data been overlooked in the specific description of apparent polyandry in early Mormon history. I should now like, therefore, to turn your attention to the certain direct evidence for my contention that all polyandry-like marriage sealings performed under Joseph Smith's direction were specified as marriages for eternity, unless the first husband either gave explicit consent to a new marriage relationship or had abandoned his wife. As mentioned before, Lawrence Foster indicated that he was unable to verify whether sealings for eternity were for eternity only. I believe I have discovered such evidence. I discovered this key evidence when I read the transcript of the only known stenographic report of a woman who tried to explain how she could be sealed to Joseph Smith while still legally married to another. Though her interview ended abruptly, she said enough to give me the clue on how to formulate my hypothesis regarding pseudo-polyandry. Based on her words, I postulated that indeed not only were there eternity-only ceilings between living persons, but also that Joseph Smith did not justify sexual intimacy for partners in such relationships. Thus again, according to Peter's definition of marriage, the woman was not practicing polyandry. For this reason, I conclude that all such cases of apparent polyandry were not polyandry in reality. I have therefore chosen to call such instances pseudo-polyandry. What provided me with my first key to this complex puzzle was the interview of Zina DeAntha Huntington. She, in fact, is the first documented case of pseudo-polyandry in the history of Mormon polygyny. Her case, therefore, provides us the clearest insight into the procedures used by Joseph Smith at the very inception of pseudo-polyandry. Her interview, however, has remained enigmatic to several generations of historians and laymen. Specifically, two features of her interview have consistently been overlooked by students of Mormon polygyny. First, the fact that she more than once emphatically asserted that she was sealed only for eternity when first sealed to Joseph Smith by her brother Demick in October 1841. This, for example, should have been sufficient evidence for Foster to have at least said that there is credible evidence that there were eternity-only ceilings. Second, she also stated that sometime later, during the lifetime of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young performed a second sealing ceremony between her and the prophet, but this time they were sealed for time and eternity. Apparently, before this second sealing was performed, Henry Jacobs, Zina's legal husband, consented to relinquishing her to the prophet for both time and eternity. Similarly overlooked crucial data exists which establishes that another pseudo-polyandrous wife of Joseph Smith, Miranda Nancy Johnson Hyde, was also sealed to Joseph Smith on two separate occasions. The first sealing date may be found in the fourth to last page of an 1843 diary of Joseph Smith. The entry is in the hand of Thomas Bullock. Really? The date given in this record is April 1842. Miranda herself provided the date of the second sealing, May 1843. This second sealing occurred after her husband, Apostle Hyde, returned from his mission. Orson had been present at a meeting held in January of 1843 when the prophet explained the only conditions under which pseudo-polyandry could exist. Quote, "I will not advise you to break up your family unless they were asked of me by the Lord. Then I would counsel you to get a bill of divorce from your wife and then marry a virtuous woman and raise a new family," unquote. Clearly, all parties had to give consent before a polygynous or monogamous sealing occurred in the wake of a pseudo-polyandrous relationship. I have discovered additional details regarding the case of Savia P. Sessions Lyon. She is the only plural wife of whom we presently have direct evidence who stated that she gave birth to a child by the prophet. This daughter stated that her mother was not sealed to Joseph Smith until after Windsor P. Lyon was out of fellowship with the church. Although she did not know the date of disfellowshipment, church records indicate that he was cut off on 19 November 1842. Sylvia's grandson further indicates that shortly after Lyon was excommunicated, he deserted Sylvia, not intending either to return to her or the church again. How soon Lyon moved to Iowa City, Iowa, over 100 miles upriver from Nauvoo, I have not been able to determine. Regardless of when he left Nauvoo, this would not necessarily coincide with the date of his separation from Savia. The unconferred date of Savia's sealing is given as 8 February 1843, 5 months after Lyon's excommunication, and approximately 3 months before Sylvia conceived a child by Joseph. Based on her understanding of early Mormon marriage forms, Bathsheba W. Smith, wife of Apostle George A. Smith, could reconcile perhaps the most volatile case of pseudo-polyandry, which was alleged to have occurred in Nauvoo, the sealing for eternity of Jane Law to Joseph Smith. Bathsheba's testimony, taken during the 1892 Temple Lot case proceedings, adds these details to the pseudo-polyandry model. Question. You had a good many reasons to know that Joseph Smith had more than one wife, you say. Yes, sir. Well, what were they? Well, circumstances. Did you ever see him out to church with anyone except Emma as his wife? Yes, sir. Take them home with him and to and from church? Yes, sir. I've seen them hanging on his arm. Who have you seen hanging on his arm? Well, I've seen Mrs. Law, if you want to know. William Law's wife? Yes, sir. Was he married to her? To whom? To William Law's wife. You can't prove it by me, for I was not present. But I believe she'd be married to Joseph Smith if she had a husband living at that time? Well, I believe she was sealed to him for eternity. To Joseph Smith. Oh, sealed to who for eternity? To Joseph Smith. Is that what you mean by marrying or married, sealed to one for eternity? Yes, sir. That is what you mean by being his wife? Yes, sir. But sometimes we were married for time and eternity, and sometimes only for time. Sometimes for time, and sometimes for eternity. I'm just reading the stenographic report. I believe... let's see. And she was sealed to him for eternity? Well, I believe she was. But you don't mean to say that Joseph Smith had that man's wife living with him as his wife? No, sir. That she was sealed to him for eternity. And I think it was a good thing for her, for she will be much better off in eternity, much better off in the next world than if she had stuck the law. That was the Relief Society president of the church in 1890. She took out time for the from the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Relief Society to be on the stand that day. Perhaps no better evidence exists supporting my view that pseudo-polyandry specifically meant that the woman's sexual activity was, on the basis of her covenants, limited to but one man, the one to whom she was sealed for time and eternity, than in the case of Sarah Ann Whitney. 8 months following their sealing for time and eternity, Joseph Smith became concerned that his marriage to Sarah might become publicized. Consequently, the prophet approached the widower, Joseph C. Kingsbury, to ask him if he would be willing to act as a nominal husband to Sarah Ann Whitney in order to spare Joseph and Sarah possible incrimination if she were to become pregnant. He agreed, and on 29 April 1843, as he explains in his diary, I, according to President Joseph Smith's counsel and others, agreed to stand by Sarah Ann Whitney as supposed to be her husband and had a pretended marriage for the purpose of bringing about the purposes of God in these last days. What faith, huh? The available evidence suggests that Joseph Smith and Sarah Whitney maintained a relationship which was never more than the prophet originally ordained that it should be. In summary, the fundamental factors which Joseph Smith believed directly bore on the question of pseudo-polyandry as follows. Priesthood is the only source of legitimate authority to solemnize any covenant relationship, including marriage. Culturally sanctioned marriage relationships entered into in good faith and continuously maintained without violation cannot be terminated without consent of both parties. The sealing keys of the priesthood can solemnize not only for time and eternity, but were also in instances of pseudo-polyandry used to seal only for eternity. The nature of post-resurrection life was known to pre-mortals, some of whom chose mates which they wished to, during their mortal lives, be sealed to for all eternity. Some males of exceptional valence promised themselves to multiple females. Fourth, when recognized by both parties, the sealing keys of the priesthood also had power to loose on earth civil marriages or priesthood solemnized time and eternity only marriages. In no case can this annulling authority abrogate either a civil or priesthood authorized marriage except by consent of both parties, or consent of the one party if the other has already forfeited the covenant by adulterous conduct. And if the covenant has been broken by one party, nevertheless, the civil or priesthood-authorized marriage will remain valid until loosed, if possible by civil, but at the very least, loosed by the priesthood authority only possessed by the prophet. During the lifetime of Joseph Smith, the rule regarding proxy ordinance work was such that ordinances could only be performed in behalf of deceased blood relations. Many faithful women desiring to be sealed to faithful men in the church did not have blood relations who were members of the church, who they felt confident would perform this work after they were dead, or who were old enough to be entrusted with such instructions. They therefore elected to be sealed to a man of their choosing for eternity only. Taken together, the evidence suggests to me that we should outright reject Brody's image of Joseph Smith as a libertine who invoked the Old Testament passage, "If a man entices a maid," in order to take wives without benefit of ceremony. The rules governing the practice of pseudo-polyandry bear out Erastus Snow's recollection of the prophet's teachings to him regarding plural marriage. The law of the Lord concerning these things is exceeding strict. Regardless of the varieties of pseudo-polyandry, ritual and reasoning were the rule rather than reckless and unprincipled promiscuity. I have here pulled together some previously unrecognized pieces of the polyandry puzzle to help us better appreciate the internally consistent logic which distinguished their acts both from polyandry and adultery. Joseph Smith only expected pseudo-polyandry to be a temporary catalyst essential to his first attempt to simultaneously introduce to the corporate consciousness of the church the concepts of priesthood legitimacy, eternal marriage, and polygyny. Pseudo-polyandry was only scaffolding for a structure of a much greater significance, a scaffolding which would be removed when these other doctrines were safely incorporated into the theology and practice of Mormonism. It cannot be construed, therefore, that Joseph Smith's revelations gave license to any of the forms of polyandry as found rarely in some of the world's cultures. It seems clear to me, then, that Joseph Smith did believe that covenants, even when solemnized by what was ultimately illegitimate authority, were binding for as long as a specific culture or country which acted in good faith felt they had authority to so officiate. Thus, when he sealed a woman to a man under the conditions that it would not take effect until eternity, not only was he resolving the problem of securing the possibility of the exaltation of a faithful sister, who otherwise might not have the chance of forming an eternal relationship, but he was also demonstrating that he did respect the law of the land as far as it had authority to operate. For example, when he received the following revelation, the wording could not be construed to mean he had authority to annul any covenant before men and women were dead. All covenants, contracts, bonds, obligations, oaths, vows, performances, connections, associations, or expectations that are not made and entered into and sealed by the Holy Spirit of promise of him who is anointed, both as well for time and all eternity, are of no efficacy, virtue, and force in and after the resurrection of the dead. For all contracts that are not made unto this end have an end when men are dead. Joseph Smith's authority to alter culturally legitimate marriage contracts could not extend beyond these limitations, except when consented to by all parties connected by the contract. In this paper, I've attempted to enlarge the theoretical framework so we can finally understand how Joseph Smith and these women understood their polyandry-like relationships. If we were to accept as divine the theoretical framework upon which they justified their conduct, then we would, as they did, reject the notion that they were culpable before the law for polyandry. They believed that in the sight of God they were neither guilty of adultery nor bigamy. They had faith that though the world would refuse to understand, God did understand. Thank you.
If someone can, I don't see a resolution. Maybe.
With a voice as loud as mine, it ought to bounce off the back wall. Several months ago, I was approached by Sunstone. I was asked to participate in a panel discussion along with Andy and Jesse Embry. And the topic of our discussion was to be my recently published book, Mormon Polygamy History. So I was surprised last week to receive my symposium program and learned that my part on the program consisted of responding to Andy's paper. Unfortunately, Andy and I should have been debating this topic on an equally informed basis. Though I was a respondent to his 1985 paper, I did not see it then either, and my deafness prevents me from hearing it here today. So I'm afraid that what we may have here is a failure to communicate, and you must listen to two parallel papers, often citing the same materials. Perhaps we can meet again in a debate under more satisfying circumstances. In order to gain an understanding of any aspect of Mormon polygamy, one should be aware of several important aspects. One, polygamy was illegal when the saints lived in Ohio and Illinois, and after 1862 was considered criminal activity in the territory of Utah. Two, Joseph Smith often viewed himself as above both the laws of the church and the laws of the land and acted accordingly. Three, church leaders from the early 1840s until at least 1904 were guilty of conspiracy, casuistry, and blatant deception in their efforts to hide their polygamous activities. Four, Joseph Smith consistently both denied and denounced polygamy in his public utterances while practicing it privately. And he was just not denying John C. Bennett's spiritual wifery either. He denied his support of any type of polygamy excepting in the life hereafter. Perhaps one of the first married Nauvoo women to be introduced to the prophet's polygamous teachings was the wife of Apostle Orson Pratt. She would be surprised indeed at Andy's definition of pseudo-polyandry. Joseph Smith approached Mrs. Pratt sometime in early 1841 while Orson was absent on his mission in Europe. During the visit, after adjoining Sarah to secrecy, Joseph reportedly said, "Sister Pratt, the Lord has given you to me as one of my spiritual wives. I have the blessings of Jacob granted me as God granted holy men of old. And as I have long looked upon you with favor and an earnest desire of connubial bliss, I hope you will not repulse or deny me. And as that the great secret that I am not to utter, Sarah replied, am I called upon to break the marriage covenant and prove recreant to my lawful husband? I never will. She added, I care not for the blessings of Jacob. I have one good husband, and that is enough for me. This incident caused sufficient difficulty between the Pratts and Joseph Smith that both Orson and Sarah left the church for a short time. Jane Law, wife of the prophet's counselor William Law, would also disagree with Andy's title. Shortly after her separation from Mormonism in 1844, she spoke to a public gathering in Nauvoo and related that Joseph had come to the Law home in the middle of the night when William was absent and told her, quote, the Lord had commanded that he should take spiritual wives to add to his glory. She further added that he asked her to give him half her love. She was at liberty to keep the other half for her husband. Lest I be accused of relying on the testimony of apostate women, let's examine the situation more closely. Some have assumed that when Joseph Smith approached married women with polyandrous proposals, he was merely testing their faith, loyalty, or virtue. In Sarah Pratt's case, for example, the 14th of September, 1877, New York Herald reported, it is said that the prophet admitted to Pratt the attempt he made on his wife's virtue, but that it was done only to see whether she was true to her absent husband. In at least two other well-documented cases, the prophet did test his apostles, John Taylor and Heber C. Kimball, by asking them for their wives only to refuse them after the obliging husbands offered them up. Jedediah Grant, second counselor to Brigham Young and father of President Heber J. Grant, commented on such tests in a Utah sermon delivered on the 19th of February, 1854. When the family organization was revealed from heaven, the patriarchal order of God, and Joseph began on the right and on the left to add to his family, what a quaking there was in Israel. But, asked Grant, did the prophet Joseph want every man's wife he asked for? He did not. But in that thing was the grand thread of the priesthood developed. The grand object in view was to try the people of God to see what was in them. In some instances, however, the prophet's intent went beyond trying the people. He did want the wives of several living men, and he took those who consented. I have documented from friendly Mormon sources the accounts of married Mormon women Mary Leitner, Marinda Hyde, Zina Jacobs, Priscinda Buell, Sylvia Sessions, and Sarah Kimball. My work on these polyandrous relationships can be found in the sources that Andy's already mentioned. Of all the women listed, only Sarah Kimball refused the prophet. She did not make her story public, however, until 1887. This is her account. Joseph Smith taught me the principle of marriage for eternity and the doctrine of plural marriage. He said that in teaching this, he realized that he jeopardized his life, but God had revealed it to him many years before as a privilege with blessings. Now God revealed it again and instructed him to teach with commandment. What Sarah Kimball did not mention in 1887, however, was that in 1884 she was happily married to non-Mormon Hiram Kimball. Like Sarah Pratt, she was not interested in the prophet as a second husband and asked him to teach it to someone else. Unlike Sarah Pratt and Jane Law, however, Sarah Kimball did not suffer church-orchestrated attacks on her character because she did not publicly expose the prophet. Although she kept the matter quiet, her husband and Joseph evidently had difficulties over the incident. On the 19th of May, 1842, at a Nauvoo City Council meeting, the prophet jotted down and then threw across the room a revelation to Kimball which declared that Hiram Kimball has been insinuating evil and formulating evil opinions against the prophet, which if he does not desist from, he shall be accursed. Sarah remained a lifetime member of the church, an active Relief Society worker, and a lifelong wife to Hiram Kimball, who eventually joined the church. If you think that the prophet's relationship with all these women was purely spiritual, non-consummated, you're wrong. Though Joseph was cited in the 19th of June, 1844, Nauvoo Neighbor as saying, they make it a criminality for a man to have a wife on the earth while he has one in heaven. He was obviously playing situational ethics, for he further added in this testimony, quote, the order was in ancient days, having nothing to do with the present times. A difficult case you must deal with, if you believe the prophet's relationships with married women was only platonic, is of course Josephine Lyon Fisher's, born to Winsor P. Lyon and Sylvia P. Sessions on the 8th of February, 1844, less than 5 months before the prophet's martyrdom. Andy's already related to your testimony, so that I won't read that. But I think under the circumstances, the name Josephine has great significance. One can understand how women such as Sarah Kimball, Sarah Pratt, and Jane Law wish to remain monogamous. But understanding the position of women who were sealed to Joseph Smith and yet continued connubial relationships with their legal husband demands more imagination. Perhaps the answer is found in Zina Jacob's subsequent sealing to Brigham Young after Joseph Smith's death. Zina's grandson recalled that President Young told Zina if she would marry him, she would be in a higher glory. This identical philosophy was also espoused by the prophet's brother, ex-apostle and ex-patriarch William Smith, just 6 years after Joseph's death. Isaac Sheen, later a prominent reorganite, wrote that Smith, quote, told me that he had a right to raise up posterity from other men's wives. He said it would be an honor conferred upon them and their husbands to allow him that privilege, and that they would thereby be exalted to a high degree of glory in eternity. Some women, steeped in such philosophy by church leaders they revered, were apparently persuaded that their non-Mormon or Mormon layman husbands could not take them to the highest degree of this coveted celestial kingdom. A Mormon male of the hierarchical rank, with feet firmly planted in the priesthood, seemed a sure ticket to heaven. Some have argued that the prophet's relationships with these married women were not polyandrous at all, that he had actually prearranged surrogate husbands to cover for him. Joseph Kingsbury wrote in his autobiography that according to President Joseph Smith and counsel and others, I agreed to stand by Sarah Ann Whitney as though I was supposed to be her husband and a pretended marriage for the purpose of shielding them from the enemy and for the purpose of bringing out the purposes of God. But Sarah Ann was single prior to the prearranged marriage. I have found no evidence that any married man agreed to give up his wife for connubial relationships with the prophet Joseph Smith. In the Henry Jacobs and Zina Jacobs case, we may have nothing here more than a blatant deception played upon Henry B. Jacobs. He always viewed himself as Zina's husband. He signed his letters long after Zina and Brigham had produced a daughter, and he always addressed his wife Zina in endearing terms as your loving husband, Henry. He suffered endless grief and torment when Brigham Young, acting as Joseph Smith's proxy, took Zina west with him as a connubial wife while Jacobs was far away in England on a mission. Are there other cases where deception was involved in the early introduction of polygamy? Was the prophet capable of duplicity? On the 13th of April, 1843, Joseph was addressing a Nauvoo group of newly arrived English saints. Attempting to influence the group to purchase bottom land property from him, trustee and trust for the church, rather than upper Nauvoo real estate from the Law Brothers and others, he advised, quote, the lower part of the town is most healthful. In the upper part of the town are the merchants who will say that I am partial, etc., but the lower part of the town is much the most healthful, and I tell you that in the name of the Lord. Now, anyone who has made a study of Nauvoo knows that the mosquito-infested Mississippi bottomlands were rampant with epidemics of malaria, cholera, and typhoid. What are the prophet's public statements on polygamy? Can his utterances be accepted at face value? On the 5th of April, 1843, just 8 months before his death, he spent the evening walking up and down Nauvoo streets with Willard Richards, keeper of his personal journal. Quote, gave instructions to try those who were preaching, teaching, or practicing the doctrine of plurality of wives. Richards noted in the diary, quote, Joseph forbids it and the practice thereof. No man shall have but one wife, unquote. It was not until much later, long after the prophet's death, that church leaders in preparing the history of the church dramatically altered Joseph's own words to read, quote, gave instructions to try those persons who were preaching, teaching, or practicing the doctrine of plurality of wives. For according to the law, I hold the keys of this power in the last days. For is there never but one on earth at a time on whom the power and his keys are conferred? And I have constantly said, no man shall have but one wife at a time unless the Lord directs otherwise. What a perfect example of benevolent deception. Helen Mar Kimball Whitney, who was a 15-year-old, was convinced by both her father and Joseph Smith to be sealed to the prophet, later recalled that, quote, I would never have been sealed to Joseph had I known it was anything more than ceremony. I was young, and they deceived me by saying the salvation of our whole family depended on it. How honest was Joseph in dealing with his wife, Emma? On the 16th of August, 1843, after the couple had had considerable difficulties over his desire to take more wives, his scribe, William Clayton, noted in his journal that, quote, since Emma came back from Swiss, he had resisted priesthood in toto, and he had to tell her he would relinquish all for her sake. He, however, told me he should not relinquish anything. So what does this all mean to practicing Latter-day Saints? Joseph Smith was unquestionably sealed to women who had living husbands. Andy Ehad's term of pseudo-polyandry is accurate in one sense. Polyandry refers to having more than one husband and carries the assumption that all involved persons consent to the arrangement. That is the distinction of the prophet's own particular brand of polyandry. With the exception of perhaps Henry B. Jacobs, none of these men were aware that their wife was sealed to Joseph Smith. It is absurd to think that these husbands, some of whom were non-Mormon or hostile Mormon males, would consent to allowing their wives connubial blessings with Joseph Smith. This is disturbing information for us to deal with, but I'm confident that we can maintain faith in the divine mission of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints without having to hide or minimize realities. Orson Pratt, despite all his problems over Joseph Smith's polyandry, resolved that quandary for himself in 1842 when he concluded that, quote, the petty difficulties existing among Mormonism's votaries cannot weaken its influence or destroy its power. Biblical prophets were less than ideal in some of their actions, yet God could work through them despite their human weaknesses. I assume that God could do the same with Joseph Smith. Thank you.